Welcome to the Drama Teacher Podcast, brought to you by Theater Folk, the Drama Teacher Resource Company. I'm Lindsay Price. Hello. I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. This is episode 195, and you can find any links to this episode in the show notes, which are at theaterfolk.com/episode195. Okay, I'm excited. This is exciting. I know you're excited because today we are talking about everyone's favorite topic. I can't even make it sound good. And we're talking assessment. Oh, and an even better topic. Rubrics. We should have great big sound fair, my fanfare right there. Assessment and rubrics. I know, and you know, assessment is so tricky in the drama classroom when there are activities that are project-based and process-based and group-based. How do we make it all happen? Well, we're here for you. We've got a guest today, a drama teacher who loves creating rubrics, and she wants you to love them too. So let's get to it. My guest is Lindsay Johnson. Hello, Lindsay.
Hello.
All right. So tell everybody where in the world you are situated right now.
I am in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Awesome.
Teaching in South Minneapolis at a charter school, teaching middle school drama for 7th and 8th grade.
Awesome. All right. And how long have you been a teacher?
I've been teaching since 2009, so
math, everybody. For a while, awesome.
But I've only been teaching theater for, this is my fourth year teaching theater.
Oh, okay. So was the plan to start something else, and you ended up in drama? What was your path?
I started with Teach for America, and I was placed in an English like reading writing environment, and so I've been doing that. I did that for the first 5 years or so. And then I taught a year of social studies randomly because that's what they needed at my school. And then my principal asked what I wanted to teach, and I said drama. So I've been doing that ever since. And I'm the founding drama teacher and the only drama teacher in our entire network.
Oh, so that means that could probably be a little bit lonely at times, I imagine.
Yeah, it is. That's why I love DTA.
That's awesome. DTA, of course, is the Drama Teacher Academy. So what's your drama background? What was drama like for you in high school and after that?
They actually really didn't have a drama program at any school I attended. So my drama background is completely in community theater. I did a ton of like community classes and then was in a bunch of plays at our local community theater all through school. And then in college, I didn't actually get a degree in theater, but I took every acting class available at my university for fun. So been really involved in theater all my life, and I did drama club at a school when I was still teaching reading and writing, and loved that. So
when the call came for you, when someone asked you what you wanted to teach, why teaching theater? Why was that the thing that you wanted?
Yeah, I think drama has always just been a huge passion of mine. It's the first thing I really felt like I got and felt like I could do it really, really well from a young age. I mean, from my own perspective, of course, but I really enjoyed it. And I love acting and I love theater. And so the idea of getting to teach that and do that, I think all of my classes incorporated drama, even though I wasn't teaching drama. Even when I was teaching social studies, we were acting out all the wars and everything. So it was just fun to make that the focus of my class.
Awesome. I love that. I love that. I know that there are a lot of folks out there who started in one path, and that drama just kind of keeps creeping in and creeping in, and then it's your life.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So the topic of our discussion today is rubrics. And I know that that's something that makes you happy, but I know there's lots of folks out there for rubrics are the bane of their existence. And it's really interesting because it's something that it hasn't been around that long. It certainly wasn't around, this mode of assessment wasn't around when I was in school. Do you remember the first time you used a rubric?
I think I tended to use them for writing more than anything else when I first started teaching, because writing was one of those things where it's kind of more subjective and harder to grade on just like a point-based system. But then I think most of the rubrics have been around drama. I haven't had to use them for much else because it's so performance-based.
Yeah.
So that's when I really dove into it.
Cool. Okay. And why are rubrics useful? I know that if other people find them that they're wary of them, why do you embrace them?
I think it's just I think rubrics are so helpful when you're trying to assess something that's subjective, that doesn't have a clear cut right answer. And so I think, like with drama, when you're watching something, there's not like necessarily specific things that are exactly what you have to see. Students can take it in many different directions and still be right. So it's trying to figure out, like, well, what are the different levels of rightness in a sense, and like what, when you're watching it later, having a sort of framework for how you want to grade them without it being too rigid. And I think rubrics are really great for that.
Well, you've just hit on a lot of things that I think that many drama teachers have difficulty with, and that whole notion of subjectivity, and that for a lot of the things that happen in the drama classroom, the right and the wrong are there none.
Right.
Right. Like and I always think about this too when I think about trying to grade playwriting, is that we're not creating playwrights, you know, it's about what else is happening in the process of it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been lucky to be in a school where there are other specialist teachers who are teaching different specialists, but who use rubrics really well. And I've learned a ton from them. And that's just what's made me excited about using them myself, because I feel like I've grown so much in how to do them.
Okay. So what's the first step in creating, if you're going to create your own, you create your own. Do you create your own? Yes.
I do. Yeah. My entire curriculum is from scratch.
Of course it is, because, you know, yeah. There is no drama curriculum, is there?
Right.
So not only are you working alone, creating your background on your own, creating curriculum on your own, and assessing on your own. Lindsay Johnson, you deserve like a crown or something. I think that.
Well, I also geek out on curriculum, so it's all good.
That's awesome. Okay, perfect. Okay, so let's start about creating our own rubrics. Where do we start?
Yeah. So I think one thing that I actually changed in the last couple of years and it's been really helpful is, so I do, I know a lot of people do like 4-3-2-1. I just label it differently and say like exceeds, meets, partially meets, does not meet. But in the past, what I always did was fill in the 4 level or the exceeds level first with what I wanted them to be able to do. And something that my school has really been pushing me on and I really like is the 4 level or the highest level is kind of like the A in the grade book, I guess. And in our mind, like if we want it to be high rigor, then the A should be exceeding what we want them to do, not just like baseline what they should be able to do. So I've actually started by putting what I want them to do or the baseline in the 3 level or the meets level, whatever the second level is of achievement. So I'll start by filling in the level of like meets and what does it look like to meet this expectation? And then I'll go to, okay, well then what does one level above that look like? What is them pushing themselves beyond or really standing out from the others look like? And that helps me decide what goes in the highest level. And then I'll go backwards from there and say, okay, well, what's one step below that? And then what's just not meeting it at all or not getting to where I need them to go.
I really like the dividing it up into exceeding, meets, partially meets, and not meeting, as opposed to getting into average or below average or above average, because partially meets, someone's trying to meet something, you know, and even if they mm-hmm. don't, even if they don't get there, then it's not like, it's not you suck but there's
right.
something
there's not part of it
there's something happening. I also like the idea of figuring out what meets the standard and then figuring out what's better, what's exceeding the standard, and then going in that direction. When I've made rubrics, I'm one of those people who starts at the 4 level whatever and then works down, but I like that idea of just working on what is meeting the standard or meeting whatever and then going ahead and going below. How do your students react to rubrics?
I think they really like them. I think that they've appreciated having a common language and a common idea of where any performance could fall. And one of the things that I was taught by someone at my school, and I won't word it as eloquently as she did, but she basically said that rubrics are ineffective unless a student and a teacher would both grade themselves at the same level using the rubric. If a student can't, if a student will look at it and give themselves a grade different than a teacher would give them, then the rubric is ineffective because there's not a common language and they don't have that. Like there's a understanding or a knowledge or skill gap there where they don't recognize where they are in the rubric. And so she taught me that like teaching rubrics and being really, really explicit and really clear about them is a way to bridge that gap and to make sure that a student could grade themselves and you would completely agree with where they're grading themselves or a peer. That's when you know that they really get it.
Okay, that leads me to my next question. How do you teach a rubric? Like, do you, is this something you do at the beginning of the year, or is it, do you like use a model, or how do you take students through the rubric process?
So when I teach a new skill or introduce a new level or row of the rubric for the first time, I'll usually start with a lot of modeling and a lot of what I'm sure most teachers do of like just giving examples either in video or my own examples or having kids come up and showing them. But then a lot of times it's just constant hits with the rubric throughout the entire week or the entire 2 weeks or whatever, how long it is before you assess it. Introducing the rubric immediately rather than waiting till a couple days before the performance and saying, oh, by the way, here's the rubric you're going to be graded on. Having it there day one, showing them what meets or exceeds looks like day one. And then every single rehearsal of that skill coming back and giving them feedback and saying, okay, where do you think that would land on the rubric? And then constant communication of, oh, okay, well, you get this piece of it, but here's where you'd actually be at partially meets, and let me show you why, and let's look at this example, and having them constantly grading each other. So a lot of times I'll have my rehearsals where they're both working like with another group, and they both have copies of the rubrics, and they need to grade each other as they watch on the rubric and explain using evidence from the rubric and from their performance why they're giving them that grade. So that opens a lot of dialogue between them, and then I can come in and correct any misconceptions. And so they're just constantly getting interactions with the rubrics so that by the time they're actually being assessed, it's not a surprise to them at all what grade that they're getting. And they're very accurate when they're grading each other because I always have them grade each other while they're watching assessments. And I find that the grades they're giving each other reflect very much the grade that I would have given them as well.
Okay. I think there's two things in here that you're hitting home and that I think I want to just reiterate on. And that notion of surprise is really important, isn't it? That students shouldn't be surprised by the grade that they get. Does it take some stress away from a performance-based rubric if they've been using it all along, do you think?
I'm sure there's like the sense of familiarity when I show them the assessment. I think I remember a lot of times in school in any subject getting that, you know, that study guide a couple of days before the test and thinking, oh man, I didn't know this was going to be on it, or I wasn't prepared for this, or I didn't expect it to be graded this way. And I think like the fact that by the time they're getting to their assessment, there's nothing new. They've seen all of it many, many times before, I think would just take an element of that anxiety out and a sense of they kind of already know going in probably what they're going to get for a grade because they've been rehearsing it so much and they've been getting so much feedback that it wouldn't come to a surprise to them if suddenly they were getting partially meets or does not meet, because they will have been getting that feedback and they will have made a choice if they want to work on that skill to improve it or not by that point.
That's right. It's like, I'm choosing only to partial. It's all in me. Well, yep. And I wonder, and it must too take away any of that accusation of, which happens, I think, when you're dealing with a subjective subject, is you gave me that mark, or you gave Jimmy that mark because you like Jimmy better than me. You think Jimmy's more talented than right. me. You don't like me. And it's like,
and then you can turn around and say, look at all your peers who gave the exact same score I did. Right.
Well, it's just, and also it covers your back. Like it has your back in terms of how you are assessing them. You know, say a parent comes in and says that Jimmy's not being treated fairly. It's like, no, this is, it's all on the rubric, right?
Right. And the other thing too, is that I require, for my class anyway, I require them when they grade each other to provide specific evidence from the performance to back up the rubric score they give. So they can't just like circle one and say, yeah, you just get meats. And because I decided you get meats, they have to actually say, like, what did you see in the performance that indicated that that would be the correct score? And then students also have to watch a video of themselves afterwards and grade themselves and list the evidence as well. So I think that I've noticed a lot more integrity on the part of the students when they have to actually defend it. Whereas some students might just go through and circle meets or exceeds for everything when they have to provide evidence. It's like, okay, well, I guess actually I was here because I can't think of anything that would have put me there. So that's really helpful as well.
Well, and now you're getting into another section, which I know that some teachers have difficulty with, is how do we teach students to give constructive feedback? And if you're using a rubric to as your feedback platform, and you have to cite evidence for whatever it is you're saying, I think too, you must eliminate a lot of, well, that sucks, that was great, without anything in the
right
middle.
Yeah, I actually have very specific sentence frames that I require students to use when giving each other feedback, and it's all linked to the language in the rubric. So it's like, you need to start by telling them which level of the rubric you put them at for that particular skill, and then list things from the rubric, from the language of my descriptor of that level that you saw in their performance, and link it to that specifically. So it no longer becomes a judgment statement of it was good or it was bad, because it was a meets because, and here's my evidence, or it was an exceeds because, and here's my evidence.
Well, and when students are, particularly in middle school, are very vulnerable to whether or not that when they do something, it sometimes equates, if they don't get a good mark, it equates to that they are not good. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That, well, I think I see it in playwriting all the time. You didn't like my play, ergo you didn't like me, and which is because it's such a, well, it's a vulnerable skill. I think all of the stuff that happens in drama class can be very vulnerable, and if we can disassociate, allow them to feel, but also to go, This is the way where we are assessing something like that.
Yeah. Well, and another thing that this might be deviating from where you were going, but this is the thing I'm most excited about this year, is my school has required, as the summative assessments we use in our class, we now have to have an exemplar for all of our summative assessments, which for most of the other teachers means filling out the right answers in their test or making an example essay. But for drama, I was kind of confused what that looked like. And they said, well, you just need to figure out a way to come up with an exemplar. And so what I did was, under each level of my rubric rows, I decided to just describe what I would be seeing or what I would be hearing from the student that would make me give them that score, like just as an example performance. And what I found was, in forcing myself to do that, it really made me refine the language on my rubric a lot, because I found myself not really knowing what I would see differently in exceeds versus meet, or not being able to articulate it well to myself. And so that was a good catch for myself of, if I can't even say what the difference is in a clear way, like I just have a general feeling about it, but don't have something clearly different I would see, then that rubric's not clear enough and I need to refine the language of it. So that's been really helpful for me to go through and just change some of the more vague language in my rubrics into much more specific language. So that's been huge for me this year. I've just been feeling like I have a much, much clearer idea of what I want my students to be able to do and what I'll actually see them doing now that I've taken the time to go and do that.
Well, and I think that's probably one of the tips of creating your own rubrics, is that specificity is king. Like, they have to know and see what's expected of them.
Yeah, because I think like a lot of my rubrics used to look like, you know, you take something like pantomiming a setting or something, you know, exceeds level would be like, I knew exactly where you were, I could tell completely by all of your cues. Then like meets is like, I kind of knew where you were, or partially meets is, I knew where you were maybe like one time, or, you know, it just gets very vague in the language. And then when you actually have to go through and write what that would look like in their bodies and in their acting, it's like, okay, well, what does that actually look like? And how would their bodies be different? And what would they be pantomiming different for me to say, I kind of knew where you were? And so it helped me kind of refine it to there was an exact setting or there was a general setting without the exact location details. Like I knew that you were in a cafe, or I knew you were eating food and interacting with food, but I didn't know you were in a kitchen versus a cafeteria. And so going into those specifics for myself was really helpful to, I feel like when I grade them now, it won't be kind of me like, oh, well, I think maybe they're here, maybe they're there. It's going to be very clear in my mind. Oh, they're definitely here. They're definitely there.
How do you assign grades to your rubrics? Like, do you, because I'm very familiar of the 4-3-2-1. Does it depend on the assignment? Does it depend on the skill? How do you assign a number to what they're doing?
I think all of our weights for assignments are kind of already factored in based on how we set up our weights in our grade book. So I don't have to worry about weighting individual assignments a certain way. So I use the same basic scoring for every rubric. And what I do is I just figure out what would equal an A and assign that point value to the four level or the highest level, the exceeds, and then what would equal a B and assign that to it. So for me, it ends up being really weird grading like 14 points for an A and 12 for a B and 11 for a C. And so, yeah, it's just a little math work that you have to do to figure out what would land on those grades that you want them to be getting.
Whatever works for you.
On a 14 point scale.
I guess it's very independent, right? Whatever works for you is what works for you.
Right.
What advice would you give to teachers who are struggling creating a rubric? Let's start with the value of it.
I would want to know what they're already using to grade. I mean, I know some people are very much knowledge-based graders, and so it's more like tests on, do you know what projection is? Do you know like what the word pantomime means? You know, like those kind of things. And I think if it's a very like cut and dry answer, then you don't necessarily need a rubric for that kind of thing. But I think when it comes to performance, I'm not sure. I'm just not even sure what other method of assessment you would use. Maybe I'm just not aware of a lot of other methods that are out there. But to me, this is one that just makes it so much simpler and so much clearer for something that's so subjective. I mean, I don't know how you would assign a score otherwise, unless I guess what some people do is they compare to the other students within the class. And they'll say like, compare to the other students, I think, you know, this group is at an A level and this one's a B level. But I think that takes the rigor piece out, and that that allows students who maybe aren't doing really well compared to where you want them to be to get graded higher because they're maybe doing better than other students in the class, even though you don't think they're actually performing at what you believe an A level is. If they're the best in the class, you feel like you have to give them an A because other students are, you know, lower than that. And so I think rubrics helps normalize rigor and make sure that you're not falling into the trap of, I know when I was a writing teacher, a lot of times I would make the A level whatever the highest level of work I was handed was, and then kind of just grade based on that when I was doing my grading. And I think that that was a disservice to students because students were getting A's who maybe weren't meeting the right level of rigor, but they were just the best in their class. So it's more helpful for me in that way to just normalize rigor level.
Oh, I think that's an excellent point because there's going to be students who are better at drama than others. And just because it's a natural thing, but there's so much value in a student should be able to get an A, not on their talent, but on what, if they can meet the standards or if they can exceed the standards,
right,
they should receive the mark as opposed to exactly as you said, the highest, you know, level of work that you're getting in the class.
Right.
That way you're taking the students out of it completely. You're just using the scale.
Right.
When you're putting together a performance rubric, what are some of the criteria that's important to you that's on there?
So what I do actually is I am a very big proponent of backwards planning. And so I start my unit, or I plan by semester. So I start my semester thinking about what are the skills that I think I want them to be able to walk away from the semester having. And so I'll list all those skills and I'll actually just go ahead and create rubrics for all of those right away, just independent rubrics for each skill. And then I go ahead and think about what are some different performances that they could do that would demonstrate these skills. And I set those up in the level of difficulty, building up to the highest level of difficulty by the end. And then I actually just pull whatever rubrics I need that I feel would apply to that particular assessment in the order that I'm teaching the skills in. So I end up using a lot of the same rubrics for every single assessment, and then there'll be some rubrics that just enter in at different points based on what I'm teaching for that particular performance. So I actually don't do it assessment by assessment. I do it by the skills I want them to have by the end of the semester, and then just apply to make sure that they're getting each rubric multiple times through different assessments throughout the semester.
So you pretty much, your semester is pretty much, you plan out ahead of time. Like everything is in place when you step into the beginning of your year.
Yeah. I work at a very strict, I guess, charter school that requires us to have all of our units with all of our assessments and all of our daily measurable objectives submitted before the first day of class even starts, so we can get lots of feedback on it and adjust it as we go, which I know is annoying to some people, but I actually really think it very much pushes me as a teacher to make sure that I'm planning to the highest level and incorporating the most rigor I can. I think when I kind of plan on the fly, I can come up with a really fun class that incorporates drama stuff but doesn't necessarily drive toward specific standards or drive towards specific skills in the best way possible. And so planning it all out ahead of time takes the stress off me and make sure I know where I'm going and make sure the skills are building in a way. And I mean, there's obviously flexibility too. If you find out students are really struggling with something, then you might decide to put more focus on that and kind of shift around things. But having a solid plan going into it makes it easier to adapt, knowing that you're still going to get to where you want to go.
And just as we wrap up here, how has rubrics changed you as a teacher?
Definitely just grown me in my ability to assess well, I think. And just as someone who didn't come into drama with like a drama education degree, it's really helped me refine what I think those skills should look like at this level. I know a lot of people are in the same boat as me where they're creating their own curriculum or they're starting from scratch or they don't have things handed to them with specific standards that have laid out for them exactly what they want the students to do at each level. So for me, this was a huge step in deciding so that I could articulate to my administrators, these are the skills I believe they should have at 7th and 8th grade level. This is the exact, like, what it should look like when they perform. And I have a strong idea of what they're driving toward. And so just like planning and everything and how you execute lessons, if you know where you're going, it makes it so much easier to get there and to articulate to others where you're going.
Well, it certainly sounds like, you know, if somebody is out there and they're either at the start of their year or they're coming up to starting their school year, that this is the place to start in terms of where do you ground, how do you teach this instead of just sort of diving in. It's like figure out what are the skills you want them to learn, figure out what the rubrics look like to and make that happen. And then you plan everything towards that final piece in a very systematic manner, you know, like it's structure is good.
Yeah. And I used to be the teacher it was all about what the final project was. That's what I cared about. And who cares about the rubrics and standards? They'll fit in there somewhere. But I think like the level, again, I keep coming back to rigor, but the level of rigor I can get students to is completely altered if I plan it differently, where I focus on the rigor and the standards and the rubrics first, and then come up with a project that helps drive toward those.
I like that. Let's reiterate that. Figure out what the rigor is, then figure out the project instead of, oh, we're going to perform something, you know,
right,
and then sort of figure out how
just
to
just hope the standards
that
get in there somewhere. Because it's theater, right?
It'll all work out. Oh, it's theater. Everything works out in theater. I've got a barn. It'll all be good. You know, it's all good. Lindsay, thank you so much for talking to me today and getting your expertise out there.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Lindsay. Oh, that sounds so weird, eh? This is Lindsay thanking Lindsay. Thanks, Lindsay. Before we go, let's do some theater folk news. All right. And as always, any links to today's episode can be found in the show notes at theaterfolk.com/episode195. And today, it's a play feature. It's a play feature. It's time to feature a play. So let me tell you about a brand new play in the Theater Folk catalog, Shreds and Patches by Robert Wing. I love this play, which is one of the criteria when we're choosing plays for the catalog. It has to be good for students. It has to be easy to stage. There's some criteria in terms of length. And then we also have to love it. We want to be able to talk about it to customers. We want to talk about it to teachers, talk about it to students. And we want to have as much vim and vigor as possible. And that's what I have for this play. Shreds and Patches is a reimagining of Shakespeare's Hamlet. The location is a wellness facility for disturbed teens, and Dane, our anti-hero, confronts his bullying stepfather and self-centered mother with the help of his fellow patients and Dr. Osric. Will Dane be able to get through to his mother about the King of Shreds and Patches, or will he be left in the dark? Well, I guess you'll have to read it to find out. But this play plays with language. Oh, it fuses Shakespearean speech with modern dialogue. The teens speak in Shakespeare and the adults speak in modern, reinforcing the notion that teens and adults speak completely different languages. It is easy to stage, great characters for teens, an excellent doorway to Shakespeare, the language, the play, to character relationships, everything in one awesome package. So you can find this wonderful piece on theaterfolk.com, where there are sample pages that you can read immediately. You can also find the link in the show notes, theaterfolk.com/episode195. Finally, where can you find this podcast? Go to theaterfolk.com/podcast. There are a ton of options. We're on iTunes, Android, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. So it's all in one stop. That's theaterfolk.com/podcast. And that's where we're going to end. Take care, my friends. Take care.